Kramer, our studio. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, I'm Phil G. I'm one of the original hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends. We're on from noon to 2 on Saturdays. All August, we're bringing you very special episodes of Grateful Dead and Friends to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the show, and KBOO is raising money for a new studio transmitter link to bring sound to listeners. Tune in every Saturday from noon to 2 and text GDAF to 44321, or go to kboo.fm/grateful to contribute right now. We also have a special commemorative t-shirt that you can find on the kboo.fm website. Thank you for your support for Grateful Dead and Friends and KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, COVID-19 cases are up 53% in Oregon as the state sets new hospitalization records. The Biden administration will recommend a third COVID booster shot for most Americans. And Clark County Sheriff's deputies will not face charges for the 2020 shooting of a 21-year-old black man, Kevin Peterson Jr. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 17th, 2021. A staggering 4,396 new COVID-19 cases were reported for the 3 days from Friday through Sunday in Oregon. Cases are up 53% from the previous week, marking the sixth consecutive week of gains. In addition, the Oregon Health Authority reported that another 14 people have died, bringing the state's total death toll up to 2,949. Oregon reported yet another daily COVID-19 hospitalization record as the state's health system is being overrun by a virus surge fueled by the highly transmissible Delta variant. There are currently a total of 752 people hospitalized statewide. Prior to this month, the state's record of hospitalizations during the pandemic was 622, set in November of 2020, before vaccines were available. Intensive care units across Oregon are about 90% full, and some hospital regions have less than 5 open ICU beds. Last week, Governor Kate Brown announced she is sending up to 1,500 National Guard troops to hospitals around the state to assist healthcare workers who are being pushed to the brink. The first group of 500 Guard members will be deployed on Friday to serve as material and equipment runners in the most overrun hospitals and to help with COVID-19 testing, among other tasks. Brown said, quote, "I cannot emphasize enough the seriousness of this crisis for all Oregonians, especially those needing emergency and intensive care. When our hospitals are full with COVID-19 patients, there may not be room for someone needing care after a car crash, a heart attack, or other emergency situation," end quote. Recently, the governor has announced various COVID-19 safety measures in an attempt to decrease the infection rate and hospitalizations and increase the number of vaccinated people. Recent measures include requiring healthcare workers and state employees be vaccinated and implementing mask mandates at K-12 schools. In addition, a statewide mask mandate was reintroduced on Friday. Everyone in Oregon who is 5 years of age or older, regardless of vaccination status, must wear a mask in indoor public spaces. Federal health officials and medical experts are expected to recommend that most people in the U.S. who are eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine should get a booster shot 8 months after their second dose. According to administration officials, providers could begin offering third shots as early as mid-September, which would apply only to the two-shot Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna recipients. The recommendation is expected as the Delta variant of the coronavirus surges across most of the U.S. Last week, the Food and Drug Administration amended its emergency use authorizations for the Moderna and Pfizer COVID-19 vaccines to allow some people with compromised immune systems to receive third doses. The change was specific to patients who have not had adequate immune responses against the virus, even after being fully vaccinated. Among the first to receive the third doses could be healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and other older Americans who were some of the first people to be vaccinated once the shots were initially authorized for use in December. However, World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has argued against booster shots, adding that low-income countries have administered only 1% of available doses, while just 10 countries have used 75% of vaccine supplies. Ghebreyesus has advocated for a moratorium on COVID-19 booster shots until the end of next month, allowing for the vaccination of at least 10% of the population of every country. A Washington state prosecutor has found that three Clark County sheriff's deputies acted lawfully last fall during an attempted drug sting when they shot and killed Kevin Peterson Jr., a 21-year-old black man from Camas. Pierce County prosecutors, who took over the review from Clark County, said deputies had the right to investigate drug crimes during the operation, and Peterson never dropped his handgun despite ample opportunity. On October 29, 2020, Peterson fled the sting and was confronted by detectives Robert Anderson and Jeremy Brown and Deputy John Feller at a nearby bank. Peterson fled again while carrying a cell phone and a handgun, and the three sheriff's deputies opened fire. Anderson, who shot first, told investigators he pulled the trigger as Peterson ran away because he refused multiple orders to drop the gun. Peterson fell to the ground after the first volley of gunfire. Security footage from the bank shows he extended his arm with an object in his hand. The three then shot again. Combined, the sheriff's deputies fired more than 30 rounds. A key issue of the case, whether Peterson ever pointed his gun at deputies, remains unclear. Peterson's family said they were stunned by the decision. They wrote in a statement, quote, "We are shocked an officer gets to shoot Kevin in the back because he's tired of chasing him. This is unfair and unsafe for everyone in the community," end quote. The family, along with their attorney, Mark Lindquist, announced in March that they intend to sue Clark County. The lawsuit has not yet been filed. The city of Minneapolis must reword a note it plans to include on this fall's election ballot after a judge said the language was problematic. The ruling pertains to a question on the ballot that affects the future of the Minneapolis Police Department. With more on the story, here's Tiffany Bowie with the Racial Reckoning Project.
The city of Minneapolis must reword a note it plans to include on this fall's election ballot after a Hennepin County judge found the language to be, quote, problematic. The reworded explanatory note will accompany a question on the November ballot about the future of the Minneapolis Police Department. The proposal, authored by the organization Yes for Minneapolis, would remove the requirement that the city keep a police department. It would replace the police department with a Department of Public Safety. City officials say they added the note to provide more information about the proposal's impact. But Yes for Minneapolis said the note was misleading and sued the city. While some say the proposal is too extreme, others say it doesn't go far enough. Adnan Ahmed, an activist living in the Twin Cities, co-authored an article on the website Left Voices, where the authors described the Yes for Minneapolis proposal as a, quote, non-threatening, palatable option. Ahmed is especially critical of its philanthropic funding, which he sees as an act of the wealthy co-opting social movements. Yes for Minneapolis has previously reported a $500,000 donation from the Open Society Policy Center.
How is money coming from foundations going to abolish or even reform police when capitalism thrives on maintaining a system of economic disparity? So what is a reformed system of economic disparity going to look like?
Ahmed says he worries that people will mistake the passage of the proposal for radical change.
But at the end of the day, we have to kind of see who is funding this, who is co-opting our language, who is co-opting our movement. And what is this really doing? If we're just kind of rearranging furniture in a burning house, then is that really progress?
More information about the question that will appear on the November ballot is on our website at racialreckoningmn.org. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Tiffany Bowie.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Wildfire smoke is posing a risk to the health of people living in the Pacific Northwest. And according to health experts, gas cooking indoors could be another risk people should consider. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Wildfire smoke is a hazard to many Washingtonians right now, but health experts say some might not get the relief they need inside their homes. Dr. Mark Vossler is president of the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. He says gas stoves also can present hazards to our health.
We think that we can escape bad outdoor air quality by going indoors, but of course, if we're burning fossil fuels in the home, we're also creating bad indoor air quality.
The potential combination of bad air quality indoors and outdoors comes as the COVID-19 pandemic rages on. A recently released study finds last year's wildfires caused more cases and deaths from the virus. Tiny particles, such as harmful heavy metals in the smoke, make people more susceptible to respiratory disease. Vossler notes you also can find harmful particulate matter that lodges itself deep in the lungs after cooking a meal on a gas stove. He says indoor air from these gases would be deemed unhealthy if measured outside.
But we're not measuring indoor air quality. You're not getting reports on your weather reports like you do when there's smoky skies, but it is dangerous.
Vossler says there's an established link between the concentration of particulates in the air and mortality. He cites other links as well. Research shows that children who live in a home with a gas stove have a 40% increased risk of asthma symptoms. Vossler says he's encouraged by the Evergreen State's goals for reducing carbon emissions and moving toward renewables, including local efforts in the state to reduce the use of natural gas in buildings. But he believes it's a different story at the federal level.
Washington, the state, is moving in the right direction. Where we're failing dramatically is Washington, D.C., where the federal government hasn't done anything significant at all to mitigate climate change.
Vossler says Congress could take a step in the right direction by passing the infrastructure and budget bills, which contain climate action measures. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The federal government on Monday declared an unprecedented water shortage for the Colorado River and Lake Mead. The move triggers mandatory water cuts and opens a new chapter in the worsening struggle with drought in the western U.S. Lake Mead, which sits just above the Hoover Dam, feeds the lower Colorado River basin, part of a longer Colorado River system that provides water for 40 million people, as well as electricity through hydroelectric dams that control the river's flow. Water supplies from the Colorado River for Arizona, Nevada, and parts of Mexico will be reduced starting in January of 2022, after the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, an agency of the Interior Department, issued a formal shortage declaration for the river for the first time in history. The water shortage declaration has been widely anticipated since May, when Lake Mead fell below 1,075 feet, the trigger point for Level 1 water cuts. Although the first round of cutbacks will affect mostly farmers, further drops in Lake Mead's water levels would mean more water reductions that could ultimately affect cities like Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Tucson, Arizona, as well as parts of California. Scientists say a combination of natural weather patterns and human-driven climate change is fueling the historic drought. Temperatures at Lake Mead, the country's largest reservoir, hit 106 degrees on Monday. The lake's shoreline is streaked with wide white stripes, rings left behind from just 20 years ago, when the water levels were more than 100 feet higher. The mandatory water cuts will go into effect in January of 2022. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, featuring Barbara Bernstein's story of several communities in the Pacific Northwest who are fighting mammoth fracked gas projects that would turn this green region into a fracked gas export hub. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 84 degrees. Today in history, in 1969, the Woodstock Music and Art Fair draws to a close after 3 days of peace, love, and rock and roll in upstate New York. The quote of the day is from Ghanaian politician and revolutionary Kwame Nkrumah, who served as the first prime minister and president of Ghana. Nkrumah said, quote, "Freedom is not something that one people can bestow on another as a gift. They claim it as their own, and none can keep it from them." President Biden stands behind the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Texas Supreme Court upholds the state's mask ban, and SNAP benefits will rise more than 25% in October. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
President Joe Biden maintains the mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to be nation-building, as the UN and other aid groups warn of a humanitarian crisis, as more people attempt to flee the country after the Taliban's takeover. Critics say the Biden administration needs to move much faster to evacuate Afghans who worked for the U.S. military and who could face reprisals from the Taliban. The Texas Supreme Court has upheld Governor Greg Abbott's order barring local jurisdictions from implementing mask mandates in the midst of a Delta variant surge. Lower courts had allowed Texas's four largest counties to implement their own mandates, but the high court kicked those rulings to the curb. Dallas Independent School District Superintendent Michael Hinojosa on maintaining a mask mandate anyway.
As of right now, I've been notified of nothing. I did get a threatening email last night from a parent that they're going to sue me today, so stay tuned. This is going to keep evolving until we get some kind of resolution, but we're prepared to hang tough.
Despite competing priorities vying for congressional attention, a virtual hearing of a House Judiciary Subcommittee on Monday remained focused on voting rights, which Democrats insist is a priority. Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark on the need to restore portions of the Voting Rights Act.
While Section 5 was in place, the Justice Department blocked over 3,000 voting changes, helping to protect the rights of millions of citizens.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi pledged in a letter to colleagues on Sunday that along with considering a massive budget resolution, the House would take up the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Hospitals saw a surge in firearm injuries in young children and inflicted by young children during the first 6 months of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a study published in the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Experts say there is an urgent need for interventions aimed at preventing firearm injuries and deaths involving children. And starting in October, average SNAP benefits will rise more than 25% above pre-pandemic levels. The increased assistance will be available to all 42 million SNAP beneficiaries. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the change will also boost local economies.
The reality is people are able to buy more, which means that folks have to produce more, have to process more, have to truck more, have to ship more, have to package more, have to shelve more, have to sell more. All of those are jobs.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org. Legal challenges are coming to the Florida Seminole Gaming Compact, and Bristol Bay fishermen donate salmon to Yukon River villages in Alaska. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. This summer saw some of the worst salmon runs on Alaska's Yukon River. But Bristol Bay processors have been enjoying great runs and donated fish to Alaska Native tribes along the Yukon River. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports.
So you're going to write the number of fish on this label?
That's Tanya Ives. She's packing up chum and king salmon to be distributed to villages along the lower Yukon River. Bristol Bay processors sent the salmon to Kwikpak, the only fish processing plant on the Yukon. This donation is about 12,000 pounds of salmon. Kwikpak is splitting it up between 10 lower Yukon River villages. The Yukon River has seen its worst summer chum salmon run on record. That means the commercial fishery is closed, and Kwikpak can't sell salmon this year. Subsistence fishing for chum and chinook is also closed, and many people along the river have not had a taste of the fish yet this season. Kwikpak boated the salmon from community to community. Weighed down by thousands of pounds of frozen fish, a tender boat slowly motors up the cold, rainy Yukon. At the helm stands Captain Darren Jennings.
St. Mary's, here we come.
Delivering salmon to the villages is new to him. In previous years, he'd be picking up commercial fishermen's fresh catch and taking it back to Kwikpak. We dock in St. Mary's. Workers from the Algatchik and Androvsky tribes load the fish into their pickups and then drive them to households all evening. A woman named Bay from St. Mary's is grateful to have at least a bit of fish.
We got two. Right now I have them thawing out so I can can them.
With little opportunity for subsistence salmon fishing, her grocery bill has gone up. Her husband, Waki, says they'll have to try for other species of fish to get them through the winter. In St. Mary's, I'm Olivia Eberts.
A memorial dedicated to Native American veterans opened in Fort Washakie, Wyoming. The Path of Honor Memorial, which features a winding red path, is the first such memorial in Wyoming. A lobbying organization that opposes gambling expansion in Florida plans to file several lawsuits in state and federal court to stop a gaming compact between the state of Florida and the Seminole Tribe of Florida. The gaming compact was signed in April, approved by lawmakers in May, and after a 45-day review period expired without comment, the Department of Interior cleared the way for the gaming compact to take effect. The compact would allow for sports betting beginning October 15th. A ballot measure initiative seeks to have the state of Alaska officially recognize and acknowledge the 229 federally recognized Alaska Native tribes. The initiative models itself on a piece of state legislation, which passed the Alaska House by a 35-4 vote earlier this year. But fighting over the state budget has gnarled future progress of the measure. The initiative would create a government-to-government relationship with the state, much in the way that the 229 tribes have with the federal government. The Alaska Lieutenant Governor has 60 days to review and certify the initiative. Then more than 36,000 signatures are required before the start of 2022 to be placed on the ballot for that year. The Tribal Trout Hatchery for the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians will complete its first phase of renovations. The project adds 2,000 square feet to the building, as well as a new generator, building insulation, an upgraded lab area, and more. The hatchery currently produces 215,000 pounds of trout every year, with the goal of increasing to 325,000 pounds annually. The tribe's manager of agriculture and natural resources says the second phase will be more extensive. The Aviv Foundation awarded one of four springboard prizes for child welfare to the Nebraska Indian Child Welfare Coalition. The coalition will use the $200,000 in funding to improve the lives of Native families and children. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
Despite pushback led by tribal leaders, the Line 3 oil pipeline replacement project in northern Minnesota appears to be nearing completion. One of the key organizers against the initiative says aside from lawsuits still playing out, pressure is mounting on the Biden administration to intervene. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The Line 3 oil pipeline for northern Minnesota could begin operating by as early as next month. The latest update comes as opponents, including tribal organizers, carry out efforts to halt the work while calling attention to action by law enforcement. According to Bloomberg, recently filed shipping notices have indicated that Line 3, which Enbridge Energy is building to replace an aging line, could be up and running by September 15th. Tribal attorney Tara Houska has been among those fighting the project. She says the Biden administration needs to stay true to its words on aggressive environmental policy and intervene.
The reality is this is one of the largest tar sands infrastructure projects in North America, and it's going through the headwaters of the Mississippi River to the shore of Lake Superior. There's been 28 spills already into the rivers. They know what's going on, and they haven't intervened.
She's referring to the 28 drilling fluid spills reported by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as construction ramped up. In one of the latest efforts to stop Line 3, the White Earth Band of Ojibwe sued the Minnesota DNR in tribal court, saying pumping of water during construction violates treaty rights because of the impact on wild rice. Enbridge and project supporters say the environmental risk has held up to scrutiny during the permitting process. Meanwhile, Houska and other self-described water protectors say nearly 700 people have been arrested while carrying out their resistance. She says she was struck by rubber bullets and mace at point-blank range when demonstrating at a construction site 2 weeks ago.
The response by law enforcement was extreme and brutal. It was one instance of many that we've experienced as land defenders.
Houska says law enforcement is incentivized to go after protesters because of a special fund Enbridge pays into to cover security costs along the construction route. Some local police agencies have criticized that characterization, saying people have the right to protest and that law enforcement has to do its job when calls come in for trespassing or damage to property. I'm Mike Moen reporting.
Groups that defend wildlife are asking the U.S. House of Representatives to pass a bill that would reinstate protections for migratory birds that were axed during the Trump administration. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Conservation groups are pushing for passage of a bill in Congress that would revive migratory bird protections that were dropped during the Trump administration. Last year, Trump's Fish and Wildlife Service lifted a rule that said companies that kill birds in the course of business, called an incidental take, would have to change their practices and/or pay for habitat restoration somewhere else. Jason Rylander with Defenders of Wildlife says the Migratory Bird Protection Act of 2021 would reinstate those requirements and not a moment too soon.
In North America since 1970, we've lost more than 3 billion birds. And so every legal protection that we have to help protect migratory bird populations is essential.
The biggest incidental bird kill in recent years happened after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010, when BP was forced to pay $100 million for killing more than a million birds. Examples of other operations that can kill birds include windmills, solar farms, oil-covered pit lakes, and water contaminated by tailings from mining sites. Rylander would like the Biden administration to create a new permit system to protect birds and give companies regulatory certainty.
And then the Fish and Wildlife Service would have the opportunity to use its expertise to ensure that project, if it moves forward, does so in the most environmentally sensitive manner.
The Biden administration has started the process of lifting the rule administratively, but the bill, House Resolution 4833, would make it harder for any future administration to give business a free pass to kill birds. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 17th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Tiffany Bowie, Trip Krause, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. News and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Food Show, keeping you on top of the news and issues surrounding the food on your plate with host Emily Becker. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact. For the past couple decades, an increasing amount of gas and oil has been fracked in an area that stretches from Canada through 11 U.S. states down to Mexico. One of the most direct routes to get these fossil fuels to market is through the Pacific Northwest. Scores of oil and gas refineries and terminals were proposed for primarily rural communities throughout the Northwest, and all but a handful have been defeated. On this edition of Making Contact, producer Barbara Bernstein takes us to the community of Kalama in southwestern Washington, where a battle to stop the world's largest methanol refinery was waged for 7 years.
Y'all excited to be here? Y'all excited to be here in the rain? Yeah! That's right, it just rain's not gonna stop us, but we are gonna stop an oil terminal.
It's the end of January in 2018. And we're standing in a large crowd of Vancouver, Washington area residents, celebrating Governor Jay Inslee's decision to pull the plug on North America's largest oil-by-rail terminal, slated for the Port of Vancouver.
Thank you, Governor Inslee, for listening to the people who submitted more than 1.3 million comments against the Tesoro Savage project. Thank you for saying no to this project that was wrong for Vancouver, wrong for the state of Washington, and wrong for the planet. And now, Governor, please help us move on to a renewable energy future by recognizing that natural gas is not a bridge fuel.
While communities across the Pacific Northwest were defeating coal and oil projects, new frack gas proposals began to slip under the radar. In 2014, Northwest Innovation Works, a Chinese government-backed company, signed preliminary leases with the ports of Kalama, Washington, Port Westward, Oregon, and Tacoma to build three massive methanol refineries. These facilities would import frack gas from Canada and refine it into methanol, which would be shipped to China to manufacture plastics.
We found out that the city and the port were planning to build the world's largest methanol refinery right here in our port.
Claudia Riedner has lived in Tacoma since 1998. She is a ceramic artist and co-founder of the grassroots environmental group Redefine Tacoma.
We had a problem here with our daily newspaper. They were throwing about 70 to 100,000 plastic bags every week with advertisements in them. And we got really upset and we decided to go to these neighborhood councils to get the community to put pressure on the city and on the paper to stop this ridiculous littering with plastic bags. So I went to a neighborhood council to talk about the plastic bags. And when they introduced the methanol project, suddenly it was very clear that those plastic bags, while a nuisance, were just like a drop in a bucket compared to being the world's largest plastic spigot to the world. I went home with a really heavy heart, and the first thing I did was research about what methanol was and where else in the world they were doing this. Finally, I was so concerned that I started the Move On petition.
I saw Claudia Riedner's water petition.
Nanette Reitz lives in Northeast Tacoma and is part of Redefine Tacoma.
I thought, what the heck is this? I didn't know anything about it. She actually had her phone number on there, and I called her. And she set up a meeting at our local community.
We decided that it was really important to go to the different neighborhoods and have different meetings. So the first meeting we organized was shortly thereafter in Northeast Tacoma, directly downwind from the port. We had a completely full house. We were totally shocked how many people showed up.
My wife went to a meeting. She came home and said, you're not going to believe this.
Val Pifone is a union representative and Tacoma activist.
We started to research and learn about the methanol refinery, the water it was going to consume, and the greenhouse gases it was going to emit. It became really obvious that this is a big problem and somebody has to step up to stop it.
We tried to talk to the city council. They would politely listen to us, but we would not elicit any responses.
They told us that they couldn't speak on the project, that they basically had a gag order. And then we find out that our mayor was in a video promoting it.
There was Jay Inslee, our governor, Marilyn Strickland, our then mayor of Tacoma, and Connie Bacon, who was a port commissioner at the time, touting methanol, touting the environmental benefits.
Tacoma is one of the few places in the Northwest where you've got a big industrial city that has a legacy of heavy contamination.
Eric DePlace is director of the Thin Green Line at Sightline Institute in Seattle.
You had the Arsarco smelter, you've got paper and pulp production at a massive scale, oil refinery that's still there. We had a joke about it when I was a kid, the Tacoma aroma, the smell that you'd notice when you were passing by the port area.
For tens of thousands of years, the port of Tacoma was an estuary that was one of the most biologically rich and diverse areas in this region.
Bill Capinci teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Puget Sound.
Then in a little more than a century, it has become one of the most toxic places in the United States.
A lot of the ports built on fill material that they brought in, say from the old Arsarco slag. Well, it's just toxic waste under there.
Todd Hay leads a data team at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and is president of Advocates for Cleaner Tacoma.
The Tacoma Pierce County Health Department is continuing to do soil removals even to this day, where the plume impacted the neighbors.
We've seen this history of, oh, we need these projects like Arsarco, but then we can't use the land for anything else until later. We have to clean it up. And guess who pays? The public pays for it all the time.
Kristen Eng is a Tacoma lawyer who was elected to the Port of Tacoma Commission in 2019.
Corporations leave, or they only want to clean up half of it or a quarter of it. Otherwise, they say, well, we'll file bankruptcy.
We heard about a meeting called the Thin Green Line. That's where we met Eric DePlace. And we realized just how threatened our little green ribbon of environment is by all these fossil fuels that are being fracked and extracted, and they need to find a way to market, and a way to market goes right through the Puget Sound area.
Northeast British Columbia, northern Alberta have just staggering reserves of natural gas trapped in these geological formations. But there are very few places that they can take the gas. By far the closest destination for these oceans of fracked gas is the Pacific Northwest. If we don't consume it, if we don't export it, if we don't convert it into a petrochemical, they don't have a market for it, and so it will stay locked up under the ground.
When people come together, there is power in numbers. We had the community, and the community was going to hold our elected officials responsible. They were going to hold this company responsible. People were going at noon on a Thursday to a port commission meeting. You have a brief amount of time to do what they call public comment at those meetings. And so you get up there and you say what you have to say, and you hope that you're educating them, and you hope that you're reaching other members of the public, and then you leave. The first couple of meetings weren't very well attended. And by the end, those meetings were standing room only.
At the beginning, the water issue was definitely the greatest concern. This refinery would have used 20 to 25% of the entire Green River that supplies water to probably 1.5 million people. This was right at a time when the city of Tacoma put signs all over town and said, please conserve water, we are in an emergency drought.
Tacoma was a pawn in a global energy game that everyone else knew about, its lobbyists, politicians, but not necessarily people who lived in this community. And that was very upsetting.
But we rallied. We had hundreds of people show up at the local meetings.
They held a couple of scoping meetings where thousands of people showed up. At this scoping meeting, everybody that wanted to could get up and say their questions, their concerns, their comments.
The company was not prepared for the questions that were being asked.
Cliff Hetridge is a longtime Port of Tacoma commissioner.
And I think that the community became extremely active in their opposition to it. What was difficult was the kind of opposition that came with people that had not looked carefully at what the issues were all about.
Thousands of people had sincere, deep, and well-researched questions. Nobody believed anything they said, and when it came to the point where they were forced to get an extension on their lease, they hadn't really produced anything about how they would try to conserve some water or conserve some electricity.
Northwest Innovation Works decided to take a pause to the project. A couple more weeks after that, they decided to withdraw the project.
While activists celebrated the demise of the methanol refinery, proponents like Lou Paulson, the director of strategic operations projects and risk management at the Port of Tacoma, saw the defeat in a different light.
I think we missed an opportunity to describe that this project was going to displace a substantial amount of coal out of the manufacturing processes in China. I think had we approached it from that standpoint, it would have reshaped the very way in which people looked at the project.
We knew all along that Northwest Innovation Works had actually planned to build 3 methanol refineries right here in the Northwest. After we defeated methanol in Tacoma, Northwest Innovation Works moved to Kalama and started up their refinery there in earnest. And we stand in solidarity with Kalama and helped them out as much as we could with posters and banners and buttons and shared all our documents and information.
Kalama is a very idyllic community. It's up on a hill. Most homes have amazing views of the Columbia River.
I can drive down to the marina, park, walk down to my boat, and in 5 minutes I can be on the river fishing.
The Port of Kalama has provided waterfront access. They're also providing access for Northwest Innovation Works.
When I moved to Kalama, I thought that the port had its big industries.
Sally Keeley is a 22-year resident of Kalama and a mathematics professor at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington. She, along with her daughter Cambria and husband Mark, have been fighting the Kalama methanol refinery since 2016.
I thought that they would be more progressive and bring in things that were more sustainable, maybe solar industry or making windmills.
It would be the largest methanol refinery in the world, which is pretty surprising because if you go to a town like Kalama with a few thousand people, nothing there is the largest in the world.
Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey was senior organizer for Columbia Riverkeeper from 2012 to 2019.
It's so out of proportion to what the community looks like, feels like, wants to be.
Many of the people who opposed the methanol refinery were veterans of past fossil fuel struggles along the Columbia River. 12 years earlier, a massive pipeline was being proposed to carry fracked gas to liquid natural gas export terminals planned for Clatsop County, Oregon, on the other side of the Columbia River, about 40 miles downstream from Kalama. The pipeline would have crossed the properties of many landowners in Cowlitz County. These residents banded together with people in Oregon and over a 12-year period stopped all of the LNG projects from being built. But as they were defeating LNG, the largest coal terminal in North America was being proposed for Longview, just 9 miles north of Kalama. So the LNG opponents refocused their efforts on fighting the coal terminal.
We were all in with the coal fight. We had actually an office in downtown Longview where we were staging all our field operations.
Columbia Riverkeeper was one of a handful of regional environmental groups opposing fossil fuel projects in Cowlitz County. Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey was their point person in Longview.
I specifically remember this fellow walked into our office, kind of just off the street, and he said, you know, I hate the coal, it's the worst thing ever. I wish we were fighting the methanol refinery in Kalama. And it was just like a message from the universe. And so we called a couple of our folks that we knew in Kalama. We asked, did they know about this? They said, yes, they were concerned, they'd like to fight it. And so we said, great, we'd like to fight it with you.
We had this huge Columbia Riverkeeper hosted meeting to try to understand the actual facts and how to give comments in hearings. 2 days later, there was a huge hearing attended by over 1,000 people, most of them proponents of the project because of the jobs that they had been promised. Cambria, at age 14, spoke at that meeting. I did too.
As a parent, mathematician, educator, and citizen of Kalama, I vehemently oppose the frack gas to methanol refinery and export terminal. This refinery would emit over 1 million tons of carbon dioxide a year.
My name is Cambry Keeley, and I'm a citizen of Kalama. Over the past 15 years, the aspects I and others have most treasured of my hometown were its pure water and clean air. Now, with the proposal of this methanol refinery, these features are threatened.
My neighbor and I attended the initial meeting to try to find out a little bit more about what was going on.
John Flynn is retired from Union Pacific Railroad and has lived in Kalama since 2010.
The more information I gathered and the more involved I got, the stronger my objection to this project became.
I got on the internet and wanted to know about methanol refineries, how large they were and where they were located. I wanted to know what the impacts of a methanol refinery were on the local community.
Diane Dick, a 34-year resident of Cowlitz County, has been involved in environmental issues since 2012.
I realized this is going to be the world's largest methanol refinery here in Kalama. Why Kalama? We're not going to use the methanol in Kalama. It's going to Asia.
NWIW chose Kalama as a soft target, somewhat economically depressed, so they came in here touting tax revenue to the county, to the local school district. Jobs, jobs, jobs.
The recipe that has been used at every facility across the Northwest is first thing you do is make agreements with the building trades that they will build this project.
During construction, we'll employ up to 1,000 construction workers.
V. Gottlieb, president of Northwest Innovation Works, gave a presentation in 2017 at a clean air permit hearing for the methanol refinery.
We'll have approximately 200 full-time direct employees during operations, and we'll also provide for 500 indirect and induced jobs because of our project.
I don't know anybody in the town of Kalama who would be qualified to work in a petrochemical refinery. A lot of the people would be brought in either from China or from the Gulf Coast who have refinery experience.
I think we've been courted by speculators and entrepreneurs who realize that there is a certain naivety about this area and a certain provincialism. We're not aware of some of the broader issues, or we're not aware of the questions we need to ask.
Northwest Innovation Works has never built a methanol plant before. This way of taking fracked methane gas and turning it into methanol has never been done on an industrial scale before.
Where they propose to put it has been on dredge spoils. This is a naturally low-lying area. None of the port is diked, so it's all subject to sea level rise. You also have the impacts of large tanker vessels coming up the Columbia River and impacting other vessel traffic and fish and wildlife.
The plant would have a 240-foot flare stack for burning off excess volatile organic compounds.
What is methanol? Methanol is naturally occurring. Our bodies naturally produce methanol as part of how we process internally. When trees break down, they produce methanol. Methanol is the simplest alcohol known to man. It's non-carcinogenic. It's biodegradable, and it's odorless.
When you have methanol spill into a river, it basically is going to kill what's ever in the river.
Methanol can consume the oxygen as it mixes with water, and so you can have a fish kill associated with a methanol spill.
Dan Sears is the conservation director for Columbia Riverkeeper.
And the Columbia River, obviously, at the mouth of the Klamath River, that's really prime fishing territory.
This project site is proposed very, very near two of my favorite spots to fish for salmon in the Columbia River.
John Flynn retired to Klamath because of the area's outstanding fishing.
And I just cannot see myself out there in my boat fishing with family and friends with this methanol refinery looming over the river and spewing clouds of vapor and potentially hazardous byproducts into the air.
People are going to have to live next to this thing and every day stare at this massive plume hanging above them with all the volatile organic compounds and other contaminants that will be coming out of it.
The methanol plant is actually a three-phase operation.
Sally Keeley, No Methanol 360.
One of which is the 3.1-mile lateral pipeline from the Williams Northwest fracked gas pipeline that runs north-south over to the Klamath methanol plant.
Through the use of eminent domain, they would force their way through private property and a pioneer cemetery just to deliver the methane gas to this methanol refinery.
Eminent domain is used primarily for things like if you need to bring a major highway through or you have to expand an airport. It's not for corporate gain. And here we have eminent domain used to take private citizens' land for a private corporate LCC company to bring in this pipeline for their methanol plant so that we can export our natural resources.
There were some people up there who might not have been opposed to the methanol refinery, but they certainly were opposed to that pipeline.
To find like the impacted landowners along the pipeline, I just like looked at the tax files, property lots, and traced what I thought was the route of the Kalama Lateral Pipeline and sent a bunch of letters saying, are you on the pipeline route? If so, give me a call. And a couple of weeks later, I got a dozen phone calls.
In September 2018, Kalama methanol opponents gathered for a picnic at the historic Mount Pleasant Cemetery near Kalama.
Where we are standing is along the proposed pipeline route that would supply fracked gas from the Rockies in Canada or the Colorado Rockies to the proposed refinery. Along the road, you'll see pink flagging tape. That's the proposed pipeline route. The pipeline would be a high-pressure gas pipeline, 24 inches, that would come along with a 100-foot construction right-of-way and a 75-foot permanent easement for the company to access the pipeline whenever they needed it. All of you are giving your time, and we're asking you to give your time in the future to help bring an end to this project, just like you have with the coal terminal in Longview and the oil terminal in Vancouver. So thank you very much.
The Port of Kalama is the landlord for the land that Northwest Innovation Works wants to build on. And Cowlitz County is slated to receive a significant amount of tax revenue from this project. All of the folks who are slated to make a lot of money are the ones making the decisions around the environmental review.
Everybody, there's Richard DeBolt. He is our state representative member, and he works for NWIW. This is a complete conflict of interest and breach of code of ethics.
Hey, Richard DeBolt,
on the way out, it is not a breach of the code of ethics to work for this company and receive money from the Chinese government. Thank you.
The president of the company, Lee Godley, was lobbying to have NWIW receive favorable tax treatment for this project. So at the same time they're saying this is going to be profitable for the community, they're trying to reduce their tax burden at the state legislature.
Diane Dick, Cowlitz County activist.
And having someone like Richard DeBolt in the state legislature casts a shadow on the ethics involved in having our government officials support these projects before the permits are even issued.
We actually did some records requests, and we found that Washington State thought that it was going to need to have its environmental review be housed under EFSEC, the Energy Facility Siting Evaluation Council. Northwest Innovation Works followed up with a few emails that we also got through public records requests saying, we actually think that it's a project that is more appropriate to be reviewed by the Port of Kalama and Cowlitz County. And unfortunately, the state acquiesced.
About a year ago, things were looking pretty grim when some of the permits were granted.
Columbia Riverkeeper, Sierra Club, and Center for Biological Diversities appealed some of the findings of the environmental impact statement and the shorelines permits, and we won. They agreed with our claim that the project would need to have a new environmental impact statement that actually looked at the emissions from fracking, emissions along the pipeline route with methane leakage, and emissions from shipping. The legal victory invalidated a number of the permits that Northwest Innovation Works was holding.
Once those numbers are made public, I am very, very hopeful that our governor, the State Department of Ecology, the Department of Natural Resources, will all come out against permitting this project.
There are two opportunities during these environmental reviews for the public to get involved. The first is scoping, and then the second is when the draft environmental impact statement comes out.
But when the draft supplemental environmental impact statement was released, local headlines proclaimed that Kalama methanol will result in a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions.
I wasn't surprised to see the way that they spun the numbers and downplayed the ramifications, in particular by choosing this ridiculously low number in the methane leaks from the fracking well site and the pipelines.
Sally Keeley, No Methanol 360.
The numbers that other reports are showing is between 2.7% leakage rate and a 17% leakage rate, and yet they chose to use in this DSEIS a 0.32% leakage rate.
That number comes from a study from the year 2000 by the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. All the science that's happened since then has shown leakage is many times worse, not only in the U.S., but also in Canada.
Peter Erickson is a senior scientist with Stockholm Environment Institute in Seattle. During comment writing workshops, opponents circulated a discussion brief he co-wrote that examined Kalama methanol's extensive greenhouse gas emissions and also questioned whether the methanol would be used for fuel rather than making plastics, as Northwest Innovation Works was claiming.
A recent paper published in the journal Science in 2018 looked at almost all the studies over the last decade. They came up with a system-wide methane loss rate of 2.3%. There's no indication that overall methane loss is really going down. And we've just had a premier elected in Alberta who based his platform on rolling back regulations on the oil and gas industry. Some of the gas for this project would probably come from Alberta. Some of the gas in the EIS that is claimed as British Columbia is not. It's Albertan. And there's no excuse for using a very low, less than 1% methane loss rate in the EIS.
In sharp contrast to the initial methanol refinery public hearings a few years earlier, which were dominated by supporters of the project, the December 2018 public hearing for the draft supplemental environmental impact statement was filled with vocal and impassioned opponents of the methanol refinery. Local residents were joined by hundreds of people from across the region who voiced their opposition, including a contingent from Tacoma. The only supporters were businesses with financial interests in the project, building trades union members, and local elected officials.
As a member of the Cowlitz County Board of Commissioners, I congratulate the applicant for its life cycle analysis of greenhouse gas emissions. In a world filled with significant trade-offs, where the good is not the enemy of the perfect, I believe this proposal is an important step forward in building a cleaner future for the entire Pacific Rim. The opponents come dangerously close to supporting a rather racist attitude if they believe we have our riches and wealthy standard of living, you don't get yours.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Claudia Wiedner. The people in Dalian, China, would be recipients of this methanol if it's not being used for fuel, but as a feedstock as promised. The people in Dalian have been in the streets by the tens of thousands because the plastic factories in China are polluting the air so badly that the people in Dalian cannot breathe. Do we want to further that? Do we want to be the plastic spigot to the world and pollute the air here and pollute it over there as well?
My name's Paul Thiers. I'm a professor at Washington State University, Vancouver. I'm trained as a political scientist, and my primary research area is China. The claim of net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions relies on this idea that the methanol will be used to feed the chemical industry. In fact, when oil drops below $80 a barrel, naphtha cracking, the traditional method for making olefins in China, is the cheapest and preferred method. If the price of oil is taken into account, it's very clear that this product is going to end up being used as transportation fuel, which will change the GHG analysis completely. And I think that the DSEIS needs to be redone for that reason.
My name is Cam Keeley, and I am a 17-year-old resident of Kalama, Washington. Northwest Innovation Works and the Port of Kalama spin their truth in their favor by cherry-picking data to put in the DSEIS. One glaring example is using stats from the United Nations IPCC 2007 assessment, but not even referencing the more recent IPCC 2014 assessment.
They, in their EIS, are using incorrect analysis from 18, 19 years ago. It really raises questions about what their motivations are, and when they don't respond to the basic points about what they're doing, it starts to look like they're purposefully obfuscating the underlying facts about methane and about how methane contributes to the impact of Kalama.
People are sick of being walked on. They're sick of being told by their decision makers that all you deserve is increased cancer rates because of this dirty coal terminal, followed by this dirty oil terminal, followed by two propane export terminal proposals. It has just been piled on to these community members in Cowlitz County, and they have had enough.
In May 2019, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee announced that he was withdrawing his support for the Kalama methanol refinery, but was allowing the permitting process to continue. Nearly a year and a half later, the Washington Department of Ecology took regulatory oversight for the project away from Cowlitz County and set in motion a second supplemental environmental impact statement for the shoreline permit.
January 21st of 2021,
the Department of Ecology actually denied the Kalama Shorelines permit.
Dan Sears with the Columbia Riverkeeper.
One of the key issues for the Department of Ecology in denying the Kalama permit was the argument that the Kalama community had been making all along, which was that Northwest Innovation Works was trying to hide most of the really damaging climate impacts of the project. The Department of Ecology concluded that the overall greenhouse gas pollution impact of the project was not consistent with Washington's climate goals. The credit for that lies with the Kalama community, who would never back down, but also to the great legal work and the organizing work that happened through a 7-year-long campaign, which just ended on June 11th, 2021, when NWIW pulled the plug and announced that they were abandoning their Kalama project.
Stopping the Kalama methanol refinery is the most recent victory over the fossil fuel industry in the Pacific Northwest. The struggle transformed residents of Kalama and dialed up the urgency to stop these kinds of developments. Although Northwest Innovation Works may still try to build its one remaining methanol refinery across the Columbia River at Port Westward, Oregon, the community is already organizing to take it on. For Making Contact, I'm Barbara Bernstein in Kalama, Washington.
You've been listening to the world's largest methanol refinery on Making Contact. This program was written, produced, and engineered by Barbara Bernstein. And I'm this week's host, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.